This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents The Signal and the Noise. Why so many predictions fail, but some don't. By Nate Silber. Read by Mike Chamberlain. Introduction. This is a book about information, technology, and scientific progress. This is a book about competition, free markets, and the evolution of ideas. This is a book about the things that make us smarter than any computer, and a book about human error. This is a book about how we learn one step at a time to come to knowledge of the objective world, and why we sometimes take a step back. This is a book about prediction, which sits at the intersection of all these things. It is a study of why some predictions succeed and why some fail. My hope is that we might gain a little more insight into planning our futures and become a little less likely to repeat our mistakes. More information, more problems. The original revolution in information technology came not with a microchip, but with a printing press. Johannes Gutenberg's invention in 1440 made information available to the masses. And the explosion of ideas it produced had unintended consequences and unpredictable effects. It was a spark for the Industrial Revolution in 1775, a tipping point in which civilization suddenly went from having made almost no scientific or economic progress for most of its existence, to the exponential rates of growth and change that are familiar to us today. It set in motion the events that would produce the European Enlightenment and the founding of the American Republic. But the printing press would first produce something else. Hundreds of years of holy war. As mankind came to believe it could predict its fate and choose its destiny, the bloodiest epic in human history followed. Books had existed prior to Gutenberg, but they were not widely written and they were not widely read. Instead, they were luxury items for the nobility, produced one copy at a time by scribes. The going rate for reproducing a single manuscript was about one florin, a gold coin worth about $200 in today's dollars, per 5 pages. So a book like the one you're reading now would cost around $20,000. It would probably also come with a litany of transcription errors, since it would be a copy of a copy of a copy, the mistakes having multiplied and mutated through each generation. This made the accumulation of knowledge extremely difficult. It required heroic effort to prevent the volume of recorded knowledge from actually decreasing, since the books might decay faster than they could be reproduced. Various editions of the Bible survived, along with a small number of canonical texts, like from Plato and Aristotle. But an untold amount of wisdom was lost to the ages, and there was little incentive to record more of it to the page. The pursuit of knowledge seemed inherently futile, if not altogether vain. If today we feel a sense of impermanence because things are changing so rapidly, impermanence was a far more literal concern for the generations before us. There was nothing new under the sun, as the beautiful Bible verses in Ecclesiastes put it, not so much because everything had been discovered, but because everything would be forgotten. The printing press changed that, and did so permanently and profoundly. Almost overnight, the cost of producing a book decreased by about 300 times, so a book that might have cost $20,000 in today's dollars instead cost $70. Printing presses spread very rapidly throughout Europe, from Gutenberg's Germany to Rome, Seville, Paris, and Basel by 1470, and then to almost all other major European cities within another 10 years. The number of books being produced grew exponentially, increasing by about 30 times in the first century after the printing press was invented. The store of human knowledge had begun to accumulate, and rapidly. As was the case during the early days of the World Wide Web, however, the quality of the information was highly varied. While the printing press paid almost immediate dividends in the production of higher quality maps, the bestseller list soon came to be dominated by heretical religious texts and pseudoscientific ones. Errors could now be mass-produced, like in the so-called Wicked Bible, which committed the most unfortunate typo in history to the page. Thou shalt commit adultery. Meanwhile, exposure to so many new ideas was producing mass confusion. The amount of information was increasing much more rapidly than our understanding of what to do with it, or our ability to differentiate the useful information from the mistruths. Paradoxically, the result of having so much more shared knowledge was increasing isolation along national and religious lines. The instinctual shortcut that we take when we have too much information is to engage with it selectively, picking out the parts we like and ignoring the remainder, making allies with those who have made the same choices and enemies of the rest. The most enthusiastic early customers of the printing press were those who used it to evangelize. Martin Luther's 95 Theses were not that radical. Similar sentiments had been debated many times over. What was revolutionary, as Elizabeth Eisenstein writes, is that Luther's theses did not stay tacked to the church door. Instead, they were reproduced at least 300,000 times by Gutenberg's printing press, a runaway hit even by modern standards. The schism that Luther's Protestant Reformation produced soon plunged Europe into war. From 1524 to 1648, there was the German Peasants' War, the Schmalkaldic War, the 80 Years' War, the 30 Years' War, the French Wars of Religion, the Irish Confederate Wars, the Scottish Civil War, and the English Civil War, many of them raging simultaneously. This is not to neglect the Spanish Inquisition, which began in 1480, or the War of the Holy League from 1508 to 1516, although those had less to do with the spread of Protestantism. The 30 Years' War alone killed one-third of Germany's population, and the 17th century was possibly the bloodiest ever, with the early 20th staking the main rival claim. But somehow in the midst of this, the printing press was starting to produce scientific and literary progress. Galileo was sharing his censored ideas, and Shakespeare was producing his plays. Shakespeare's plays often turn on the idea of fate, as much drama does. What makes them so tragic is the gap between what his characters might like to accomplish and what fate provides to them. The idea of controlling one's fate seemed to have become part of human consciousness by Shakespeare's time, but not yet the competencies to achieve that end. Instead, those who tested fate usually wound up dead. These themes are explored most vividly in the tragedy of Julius Caesar. Throughout the first half of the play, Caesar receives all sorts of apparent warning signs, what he calls predictions. Beware the Ides of March. That his coronation could turn into a slaughter. Caesar, of course, ignores these signs, quite proudly insisting that they point to someone else's death, or otherwise reading the evidence selectively. Then Caesar is assassinated. But men may construe things after their fashion, clean from the purpose of the things themselves, Shakespeare warns us through the voice of Cicero. Good advice for anyone seeking to pluck through their newfound wealth of information. It was hard to tell the signal from the noise. The story the data tells us is often the one we'd like to hear, and we usually make sure that it has a happy ending. And yet, if the tragedy of Julius Caesar turned on an ancient idea of prediction, associating it with fatalism, fortune-telling, and superstition, it also introduced a more modern and altogether more radical idea, that we might interpret these signs so as to gain an advantage from them. Men at some time are masters of their fates, says Cassius, hoping to persuade Brutus to partake in the conspiracy against Caesar. The idea of man as master of his fate was gaining currency. The words predict and forecast are largely used interchangeably today. But in Shakespeare's time, they meant different things. A prediction was what the soothsayer told you. A forecast was something more like Cassius's idea. The term forecast came from English's Germanic roots, unlike predict, which is from Latin. Forecasting reflected the new Protestant worldliness rather than the otherworldliness of the Holy Roman Empire. Making a forecast typically implied planning under conditions of uncertainty. It suggested having prudence, wisdom, and industriousness, more like the way we now use the word foresight. The theological implications of this idea are complicated, but they were less so for those hoping to make a gainful existence in the terrestrial world. These qualities were strongly associated with a Protestant work ethic, which Max Weber saw as bringing about capitalism and the Industrial Revolution. This notion of forecasting was very much tied in to the notion of progress. All that information in all those books ought to have helped us to plan our lives and profitably predict the world's course. The Protestants who ushered in centuries of holy war were learning how to use their accumulated knowledge to change society. The Industrial Revolution largely began in Protestant countries, and largely in those with a free press, where both religious and scientific ideas could flow without fear of censorship. The importance of the Industrial Revolution is hard to overstate. Throughout essentially all of human history, economic growth had proceeded at a rate of perhaps 0.1% per year, enough to allow for a very gradual increase in population, but not any growth in per capita living standards. And then suddenly, there was progress when there had been none. Economic growth began to zoom upward much faster than the growth rate of the population, as it has continued to do through to the present day, the occasional global financial meltdown notwithstanding. The explosion of information produced by the printing press had done us a world of good, it turned out. It had just taken 330 years, and millions dead in battlefields around Europe, for those advantages to take hold. The productivity paradox. We face danger whenever information growth outpaces our understanding of how to process it. The last 40 years of human history imply that it can still take a long time to translate information into useful knowledge, and that if we are not careful, we may take a step back in the meantime. The term information age is not particularly new. It started to come into more widespread use in the late 1970s. The related term, computer age, was used earlier still, starting in about 1970. It was at around this time that computers began to be used more commonly in laboratories and academic settings, even if they had not yet become common as home appliances. This time, it did not take 300 years before the growth in information technology began to produce tangible benefits to human society. But it did take 15 to 20. The 1970s were the high point for vast amounts of theory applied to extremely small amounts of data, as Paul Krugman put it to me. We had begun to use computers to produce models of the world, but it took us some time to recognize how crude and assumption-laden they were, and that the precision that computers were capable of was no substitute for predictive accuracy. In fields ranging from economics to epidemiology, this was an era in which bold predictions were made, and equally often failed. In 1971, for instance, it was claimed that we would be able to predict earthquakes within a decade, a problem that we are no closer to solving 40 years later. Instead, the computer boom of the 1970s and 1980s produced a temporary decline in economic and scientific productivity. Economists term this the productivity paradox. You can see the computer age everywhere, but in the productivity statistics, wrote the economist Robert Solow in 1987. The United States experienced four distinct recessions between 1969 and 1982. The late 1980s were a stronger period for our economy, but less so for countries elsewhere in the world. Scientific progress is harder to measure than economic progress. But one mark of it is the number of patents produced, especially relative to the investment in research and development. If it has become cheaper to produce a new invention, this suggests that we are using our information wisely and are forging it into knowledge. If it is becoming more expensive, this suggests that we are seeing signals in the noise and wasting our time on false leads. In the 1960s, the United States spent about $1.5 million, adjusted for inflation, per patent application by an American inventor. That figure rose rather than fell at the dawn of the information age, however, doubling to a peak of about $3 million in 1986. As we came to more realistic views of what that new technology could accomplish for us, our research productivity began to improve again in the 1990s. We wandered up fewer blind alleys. Computers began to improve our everyday lives and help our economy. Stories of prediction are often those of long-term progress, but short-term regress. Many things that seem predictable over the long run foil our best-laid plans in the meanwhile. The promise and pitfalls of big data. The fashionable term now is big data. IBM estimates that we are generating 2.5 quintillion bytes of data each day, more than 90% of which was created in the last 2 years. This exponential growth in information is sometimes seen as a cure-all, as computers were in the 1970s. Chris Anderson, the editor of Wired magazine, wrote in 2008 that the sheer volume of data would obviate the need for theory, and even the scientific method. This is an emphatically pro-science and pro-technology book, and I think of it as a very optimistic one. But it argues that these views are badly mistaken. The numbers have no way of speaking for themselves. We speak for them. We imbue them with meaning. Like Caesar, we may construe them in self-serving ways that are detached from their objective reality. Data-driven predictions can succeed, and they can fail. It is when we deny our role in the process that the odds of failure rise. Before we demand more of our data, we need to demand more of ourselves. This attitude might seem surprising if you know my background. I have a reputation for working with data and statistics, and using them to make successful predictions. In 2003, bored at a consulting job, I designed a system called PECODA, which sought to predict the statistics of Major League Baseball players. It contained a number of innovations. Its forecasts were probabilistic, for instance, outlining a range of possible outcomes for each player. And we found that it outperformed competing systems when we compared their results. In 2008, I founded the website 538, which sought to forecast the upcoming election. The 538 forecasts correctly predicted the winner of the presidential contest in 49 of 50 states, as well as the winner of all 35 U.S. Senate races. After the election, I was approached by a number of publishers who wanted to capitalize on the success of books such as Moneyball and Freakonomics that told the story of nerds conquering the world. This book was conceived of along those lines, as an investigation of data-driven predictions in fields ranging from baseball to finance to national security. But in speaking with well more than 100 experts in more than a dozen fields over the course of 4 years, reading hundreds of journal articles and books, and traveling everywhere from Las Vegas to Copenhagen in pursuit of my investigation, I came to realize that prediction in the era of big data was not going very well. I had been lucky on a few levels. First, in having achieved success despite having made many of the mistakes that I will describe, and second, and having chosen my battles well. Baseball, for instance, is an exceptional case. It happens to be an especially rich and revealing exception. And the book considers why this is so. Why a decade after Moneyball, stat geeks and scouts are now working in harmony. The book offers some other hopeful examples. Weather forecasting, which also involves a melding of human judgment and computer power, is one of them. Meteorologists have a bad reputation, but they have made remarkable progress, being able to forecast the landfall position of a hurricane 3 times more accurately than they were a quarter century ago. Meanwhile, I met poker players and sports bettors who really were beating Las Vegas, and the computer programmers who built IBM's Deep Blue and took down a world chess champion. But these cases of progress in forecasting must be weighed against a series of failures. If there is one thing that defines Americans, one thing that makes us exceptional, it is our belief in Cassius's idea that we are in control of our own fates. Our country was founded at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution by religious rebels who had seen that the free flow of ideas had helped to spread not just their religious beliefs, but also those of science and commerce. Most of our strengths and weaknesses as a nation, our ingenuity and our industriousness, our arrogance and our impatience, stem from our unshakable belief in the idea that we choose our own course. But the new millennium got off to a terrible start for Americans. We had not seen the September 11th attacks coming. The problem was not want of information. As had been the case in the Pearl Harbor attacks 6 decades earlier, all the signals were there. But we had not put them together. Lacking a proper theory for how terrorists might behave, we were blind to the data, and the attacks were an unknown unknown to us. There also were the widespread failures of prediction that accompanied the recent global financial crisis. Our naive trust in models and our failure to realize how fragile they were to our choice of assumptions yielded disastrous results. On a more routine basis, meanwhile, I discovered that we are unable to predict recessions more than a few months in advance, and not for lack of trying. While there has been considerable progress made in controlling inflation, our economic policymakers are otherwise flying blind. The forecasting models published by political scientists in advance of the 2000 presidential election predicted a landslide 11-point victory for Al Gore. George W. Bush won instead. Rather than being an anomalous result, failures like these have been fairly common in political prediction. A long-term study by Philip E. Tetlock of the University of Pennsylvania found that when political scientists claimed that a political outcome had absolutely no chance of occurring, it nevertheless happened about 15% of the time. The political scientists are probably better than television pundits, however. There has recently been, as in the 1970s, a revival of attempts to predict earthquakes, most of them using highly mathematical and data-driven techniques. But these predictions envisaged earthquakes that never happened and failed to prepare us for those that did. The Fukushima nuclear reactor had been designed to handle a magnitude 8.6 earthquake, in part because some seismologists concluded that anything larger was impossible. Then came Japan's horrible magnitude 9.1 earthquake in March 2011. There are entire disciplines in which predictions have been failing, often at great cost to society. Consider something like biomedical research. In 2005, an Athens-raised medical researcher named John P. Ioannidis published a controversial paper titled "Why Most Published Research Findings Are False." The paper studied positive findings documented in peer-reviewed journals, descriptions of successful predictions of medical hypotheses carried out in laboratory experiments. It concluded that most of these findings were likely to fail when applied in the real world. Bayer Laboratories recently confirmed Ioannidis' hypothesis. They could not replicate about two-thirds of the positive findings claimed in medical journals when they attempted the experiments themselves. Big data will produce progress. Eventually. How quickly it does, and whether we regress in the meantime, will depend on us. Why the future shocks us. Biologically, we are not very different from our ancestors. But some Stone Age strengths have become Information Age weaknesses. Human beings do not have very many natural defenses. We are not all that fast, and we are not all that strong. We do not have claws or fangs or body armor. We cannot spit venom. We cannot camouflage ourselves. And we cannot fly. Instead, we survive by means of our wits. Our minds are quick. We are wired to detect patterns and respond to opportunities and threats without much hesitation. This need of finding patterns, humans have this more than other animals, I was told by Tommaso Poggio, an MIT neuroscientist who studies how our brains process information. Recognizing objects in difficult situations means generalizing. A newborn baby can recognize the basic pattern of a face. It has been learned by evolution, not by the individual. The problem, Poggio says, is that these evolutionary instincts sometimes lead us to see patterns when there are none there. People have been doing that all the time, Poggio said, finding patterns in random noise. The human brain is quite remarkable. It can store perhaps 3 terabytes of information. and yet that is only about 1/1,000,000th of the information that IBM says is now produced in the world each day. So we have to be terribly selective about the information we choose to remember. Alvin Toffler, writing in the book Future Shock in 1970, predicted some of the consequences of what he called information overload. He thought our defense mechanism would be to simplify the world in ways that confirmed our biases, even as the world itself was growing more diverse and more complex. Our biological instincts are not always very well adapted to the information-rich modern world. Unless we work actively to become aware of the biases we introduce, the returns to additional information may be minimal or diminishing. The information overload after the birth of the printing press produced greater sectarianism. Now those different religious ideas could be testified to with more information, more conviction, more proof, and less tolerance for dissenting opinion. The same phenomenon seems to be occurring today. Political partisanship began to increase very rapidly in the United States, beginning at about the time that Toffler wrote Future Shock, and it may be accelerating even faster with the advent of the Internet. These partisan beliefs can upset the equation in which more information will bring us closer to the truth. A recent study in Nature found that the more informed that strong political partisans were about global warming, the less they agreed with one another. Meanwhile, if the quantity of information is increasing by 2.5 quintillion bytes per day, the amount of useful information almost certainly isn't. Most of it is just noise, and the noise is increasing faster than the signal. There are so many hypotheses to test, so many data sets to mine, but a relatively constant amount of objective truth. The printing press changed the way in which we made mistakes. Routine errors of transcription became less common. But when there was a mistake, it would be reproduced many times over, as in the case of the Wicked Bible. Complex systems like the World Wide Web have this property. They may not fail as often as simpler ones, but when they fail badly. Capitalism and the Internet, both of which are incredibly efficient at propagating information, create the potential for bad ideas as well as good ones to spread. The bad ideas may produce disproportionate effects. In advance of the financial crisis, the system was so highly levered that a single lax assumption in the credit rating agency's models played a huge role in bringing down the whole global financial system. Regulation is one approach to solving these problems. But I am suspicious that it is an excuse to avoid looking within ourselves for answers. We need to stop and admit it. We have a prediction problem. We love to predict things, and we aren't very good at it. The prediction solution. If prediction is the central problem of this book, it is also its solution. Prediction is indispensable to our lives. Every time we choose a route to work, decide whether to go on a second date, or set money aside for a rainy day, we are making a forecast about how the future will proceed and how our plans will affect the odds for a favorable outcome. Not all of these day-to-day problems require strenuous thought. We can budget only so much time to each decision. Nevertheless, you are making predictions many times every day, whether or not you realize it. For this reason, this book views prediction as a shared enterprise rather than as a function that a select group of experts or practitioners perform. It is amusing to poke fun at the experts when their predictions fail. However, we should be careful with our schadenfreude. To say our predictions are no worse than the experts is to damn ourselves with some awfully faint praise. Prediction does play a particularly important role in science, however. Some of you may be uncomfortable with a premise that I have been hinting at and will now state explicitly. We can never make perfectly objective predictions. They will always be tainted by our subjective point of view. But this book is emphatically against the nihilistic viewpoint that there is no objective truth. It asserts, rather, that a belief in the objective truth and a commitment to pursuing it is the first prerequisite of making better predictions. The forecaster's next commitment is to realize that she perceives it imperfectly. Prediction is important because it connects subjective and objective reality. Karl Popper, the philosopher of science, recognized this view. For Popper, a hypothesis was not scientific unless it was falsifiable, meaning that it could be tested in the real world by means of a prediction. What should give us pause is that the few ideas we have tested aren't doing so well, and many of our ideas have not or cannot be tested at all. In economics, it is much easier to test an unemployment rate forecast than a claim about the effectiveness of stimulus spending. In political science, we can test models that are used to predict the outcome of elections. But a theory about how changes to political institutions might affect policy outcomes could take decades to verify. I do not go as far as Popper in asserting that such theories are therefore unscientific or that they lack any value. However, the fact that the few theories we can test have produced quite poor results suggests that many of the ideas we haven't tested are very wrong as well. We are undoubtedly living with many delusions that we do not even realize. But there is a way forward. It is not a solution that relies on half-baked policy ideas, particularly given that I have come to view our political system as a big part of the problem. Rather, the solution requires an attitudinal change. This attitude is embodied by something called Bayes' theorem, which I introduce in Chapter 8. Bayes' theorem is nominally a mathematical formula, but it is really much more than that. It implies that we must think differently about our ideas and how to test them. We must become more comfortable with probability and uncertainty. We must think more carefully about the assumptions and beliefs that we bring to a problem. The book divides roughly into halves. The first 7 chapters diagnose the prediction problem, while the final 6 explore and apply Bayes' solution. Each chapter is oriented around a particular subject and describes it in some depth. There is no denying that this is a detailed book, in part because that is often where the devil lies, and in part because my view is that a certain amount of immersion in a topic will provide disproportionately more insight than an executive summary. The subjects I have chosen are usually those in which there is some publicly shared information. There are fewer examples of forecasters making predictions based on private information. For instance, how a company uses its customer records to forecast demand for a new product. My preference is for topics where you can check out the results for yourself rather than having to take my word for it. A short roadmap to the book. The book weaves between examples from the natural sciences, the social sciences, and from sports and games. The book builds from relatively straightforward cases where the successes and failures of prediction are more easily demarcated into others that require slightly more finesse. Chapters 1 through 3 consider the failures of prediction surrounding the recent financial crisis, the successes in baseball, and the realm of political prediction, where some approaches have worked well and others haven't. They should get you thinking about some of the most fundamental questions that underlie the prediction problem. How can we apply our judgment to the data without succumbing to our biases? When does market competition make forecasts better? And how can it make them worse? How do we reconcile the need to use the past as a guide with our recognition that the future may be different? Chapters 4 through 7 focus on dynamic systems, the behavior of the Earth's atmosphere, which brings about the weather, the movement of its tectonic plates, which can cause earthquakes, and the complex human interactions that account for the behavior of the American economy, and the spread of infectious diseases. These systems are being studied by some of our best scientists, but dynamic systems make forecasting more difficult, and predictions in these fields have not always gone very well. Chapters 8 through 10 turn towards solutions. First, by introducing you to a sports bettor who applies Bayes' theorem more expertly than many economists or scientists do, and then by considering 2 other games, chess and poker. Sports and games, because they follow well-defined rules, represent good laboratories for testing our predictive skills. They help us to a better understanding of randomness and uncertainty, and provide insight about how we might forge information into knowledge. Bayes' theorem, however, can also be applied to more existential types of problems. Chapters 11 through 13 consider three of these cases: global warming, terrorism, and bubbles in financial markets. These are hard problems for forecasters and for society. But if we are up to the challenge, we can make our country, our economy, and our planet a little safer. The world has come a long way since the days of the printing press. Information is no longer a scarce commodity. We have more of it than we know what to do with. But relatively little of it is useful. We perceive it selectively, subjectively, and without much self-regard for the distortions that this causes. We think we want information when we really want knowledge. The signal is the truth. The noise is what distracts us from the truth. This is a book about the signal and the noise. Chapter 1. A Catastrophic Failure of Prediction. It was October 23, 2008. The stock market was in freefall, having plummeted almost 30% over the previous 5 weeks. Once esteemed companies like Lehman Brothers had gone bankrupt. Credit markets had all but ceased to function. Houses in Las Vegas had lost 40% of their value. Unemployment was skyrocketing. Hundreds of billions of dollars had been committed to failing financial firms. Confidence in government was the lowest that pollsters had ever measured. The presidential election was less than 2 weeks away. Congress, normally dormant so close to an election, was abuzz with activity. The bailout bills it had passed were sure to be unpopular, and it needed to create every impression that the wrongdoers would be punished. The House Oversight Committee had called the heads of the three major credit rating agencies, Standard & Poor's, S&P, Moody's, and Fitch Ratings, to testify before them. The ratings agencies were charged with assessing the likelihood that trillions of dollars in mortgage-backed securities would go into default. To put it mildly, it appeared they had blown the call. The worst prediction of a sorry lot. The financial crisis of the late 2000s is often thought of as a failure of our political and finance institutions. It was obviously an economic failure of massive proportions. By 2011, 4 years after the Great Recession officially began, the American economy was still almost $800 billion below its productive potential. I am convinced, however, that the best way to view the financial crisis is as a failure of judgment, a catastrophic failure of prediction. These predictive failures were widespread, occurring at virtually every stage during, before, and after the crisis, and involving everyone from the mortgage brokers to the White House. The most calamitous failures of prediction usually have a lot in common. We focus on those signals that tell a story about the world as we would like it to be, not how it really is. We ignore the risks that are hardest to measure, even when they pose the greatest threats to our well-being. We make approximations and assumptions about the world that are much cruder than we realize. We abhor uncertainty, even when it is an irreducible part of the problem we are trying to solve. If we want to get at the heart of the financial crisis, we should begin by identifying the greatest predictive failure of all, a prediction that committed all these mistakes. The rating agencies had given their AAA rating, normally reserved for a handful of the world's most solvent governments and best-run businesses, to thousands of mortgage-backed securities, financial instruments that allowed investors to bet on the likelihood of someone else defaulting on their home. The ratings issued by these companies are quite explicitly meant to be predictions, estimates of the likelihood that a piece of debt will go into default. Standard & Poor's told investors, for instance, that when it rated a particularly complex type of security known as a collateralized debt obligation, CDO, at AAA, there was only a 0.12% probability, about one chance in 850, that it would fail to pay out over the next 5 years. This supposedly made it as safe as a AAA-rated corporate bond and safer than S&P now assumes U.S. Treasury bonds to be. The rating agencies do not grade on a curve. In fact, around 28% of the AAA-rated CDOs defaulted, according to S&P's internal figures. Some independent estimates are even higher. That means that the actual default rates for CDOs were more than 200 times higher than S&P had predicted. This is just about as complete a failure as it is possible to make in a prediction. Trillions of dollars in investments that were rated as being almost completely safe instead turned out to be almost completely unsafe. It was as if the weather forecast had been 86 degrees and sunny, and instead there was a blizzard. When you make a prediction that goes so badly, you have a choice of how to explain it. One path is to blame external circumstances, what we might think of as bad luck. Sometimes this is a reasonable choice, or even the correct one. When the National Weather Service says there is a 90% chance of clear skies, but it rains instead and spoils your golf outing, you can't really blame them. Decades of historical data show that when the Weather Service says there is a 1 in 10 chance of rain, it really does rain about 10% of the time over the long run. This explanation becomes less credible, however, when the forecaster does not have a history of successful predictions and when the magnitude of his error is larger. In these cases, it is much more likely that the fault lies with the forecaster's model of the world and not with the world itself. In the instance of CDOs, the ratings agencies had no track record at all. These were new and highly novel securities, and the default rates claimed by S&P were not derived from historical data, but instead were assumptions based on a faulty statistical model. Meanwhile, the magnitude of their error was enormous. AAA-rated CDOs were 200 times more likely to default in practice than they were in theory. The ratings agency's shot at redemption would be to admit that the models had been flawed and the mistake had been theirs. But at the congressional hearing, they shirked responsibility and claimed to have been unlucky. They blamed an external contingency, the housing bubble. S&P is not alone in having been taken by surprise by the extreme decline in the housing and mortgage markets. Devin Sharma, the head of Standard & Poor's, told Congress that October. Virtually no one, be they homeowners, financial institutions, rating agencies, regulators, or investors, anticipated what is coming. Nobody saw it coming. When you can't state your innocence, proclaim your ignorance. This is often the first line of defense when there is a failed forecast. But Sharma's statement was a lie in the grand congressional tradition of, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman," and "I have never used steroids." What is remarkable about the housing bubble is the number of people who did see it coming, and who said so well in advance. Robert Shiller, the Yale economist, had noted its beginnings as early as 2000 in his book Irrational Exuberance. Dean Baker, a caustic economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, had written about the bubble in August 2002. A correspondent at The Economist magazine, normally known for its staid prose, had spoken of the biggest bubble in history in June 2005. Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, wrote of the bubble and its inevitable end in August 2005. "This was baked into the system," Krugman later told me. "The housing crash was not a black swan. The housing crash was the elephant in the room." Ordinary Americans were also concerned. Google searches on the term housing bubble increased roughly tenfold from January 2004 through summer 2005. Interest in the term was heaviest in those states, like California, that had seen the largest run-up in housing prices, and which were about to experience the largest decline. In fact, discussion of the bubble was remarkably widespread. Instances of the two-word phrase housing bubble had appeared in just 8 news accounts in 2001, but jumped to 3,447 references by 2005. The housing bubble was discussed about 10 times per day in reputable newspapers and periodicals. And yet, the rating agencies, whose job it is to measure risk in financial markets, say that they missed it. It should tell you something that they seem to think of this as their best line of defense. The problems with their predictions ran very deep. I don't think they wanted the music to stop. None of the economists and investors I spoke with for this chapter had a favorable view of the ratings agencies, but they were divided on whether their bad ratings reflected avarice or ignorance. Did they know any better? Jules Krull is perhaps uniquely qualified to pass judgment on this question. He runs a rating agency himself. Founded in 2009, Kroll Bond Ratings had just issued its first rating on a mortgage loan made to the builders of a gigantic shopping center in Arlington, Virginia, when I met him at his office in New York in 2011. Kroll faults the rating agencies most of all for their lack of surveillance. It is an ironic term coming from Kroll, who before getting into the ratings game had become modestly famous and somewhat immodestly rich from his original company, Kroll Inc., which acted as a sort of detective agency to patrol corporate fraud. They knew how to sniff out a scam, such as the case of the kidnappers who took a hedge fund billionaire hostage, but foiled themselves by charging a pizza to his credit card. Kroll was 69 years old when I met him, but his bloodhound instincts are keen, and they were triggered when he began to examine what the rating agencies were doing. Surveillance is a term of art in the ratings industry, Kroll told me. It means keeping investors informed as to what you're seeing. Every month you get a tape of things like defaults on mortgages, prepayment of mortgages. You get a lot of data. That is the early warning. Are things getting better or worse? The world expects you to keep them posted. The rating agencies ought to have been just about the first ones to detect problems in the housing market, in other words. They had better information than anyone else. Fresh data on whether thousands of borrowers were making their mortgage payments on time. But they did not begin to downgrade large batches of mortgage-backed securities until 2007, at which point the problems had become manifest and foreclosure rates had already doubled. These are not stupid people, Kroll told me. They knew. I don't think they wanted the music to stop. Kroll Bond Ratings is one of 10 registered NRSROs, or nationally recognized statistical rating organizations, firms that are licensed by the Securities and Exchange Commission to rate debt-backed securities. But Moody's, S&P, and Fitch are three of the others, and they have had almost all the market share. S&P and Moody's each rated almost 97% of the CDOs that were issued prior to the financial collapse. One reason that S&P and Moody's enjoyed such a dominant market presence is simply that they had been a part of the club for a long time. They are part of a legal oligopoly. Entry into the industry is limited by the government. Meanwhile, a seal of approval from S&P and Moody's is often mandated by the bylaws of large pension funds, about two-thirds of which mention S&P, Moody's, or both by name, requiring that they rate a piece of debt before the pension fund can purchase it. S&P and Moody's had taken advantage of their select status to build up exceptional profits, despite picking resumes out of Wall Street's reject pile. Moody's revenue from so-called structured finance ratings increased by more than 800% between 1997 and 2007, and came to represent the majority of their ratings business during the bubble years. These products helped Moody's to the highest profit margin of any company in the S&P 500 for five consecutive years during the housing bubble. In 2010, even after the bubble burst and the problems with the rating agencies had become obvious, Moody's still made a 25% profit. With large profits locked in so long as new CDOs continued to be issued, and no way for investors to verify the accuracy of their ratings until it was too late, the agencies had little incentive to compete on the basis of quality. The CEO of Moody's, Raymond McDaniel, explicitly told his board that ratings quality was the least important factor driving the company's profits. Instead, their equation was simple. The ratings agencies were paid by the issuer of the CDO every time they rated one. The more CDOs, the more profit. A virtually unlimited number of CDOs could be created by combining different types of mortgages, or when that got boring, combining different types of CDOs into derivatives of one another. Rarely did the ratings agencies turn down the opportunity to rate one. A government investigation later uncovered an instant message exchange between two senior Moody's employees in which one claimed that a security could be structured by cows and Moody's would rate it. In some cases, the ratings agencies went further still and abetted debt issuers in manipulating the ratings. In what it claimed was a nod to transparency, S&P provided the issuers with copies of their rating software. This made it easy for the issuers to determine exactly how many bad mortgages they could add to the pool without seeing its rating decline. The possibility of a housing bubble, and that it might burst, thus represented a threat to the ratings agency's gravy train. Human beings have an extraordinary capacity to ignore risks that threaten their livelihood, as though this will make them go away. So perhaps Devin Sharma's claim isn't so implausible. Perhaps the rating agencies really had missed the housing bubble, even if others hadn't. In fact, however, the rating agencies quite explicitly considered the possibility that there was a housing bubble. They concluded, remarkably, that it would be no big deal. A memo provided to me by an S&P spokeswoman, Catherine Mathis, detailed how S&P had conducted a simulation in 2005 that anticipated a 20% decline in national housing prices over a two-year period, not far from the roughly 30% decline in housing prices that actually occurred between 2006 and 2008. The memo concluded that S&P's existing models captured the risk of a downturn adequately, and that its highly rated securities would weather a housing downturn without suffering a credit rating downgrade. In some ways, this is even more troubling than if the ratings agencies had missed the housing bubble entirely. In this book, I'll discuss the danger of unknown unknowns, the risks that we are not even aware of. Perhaps the only greater threat is the risks we think we have a handle on, but don't. In these cases, we not only fool ourselves, but our false confidence may be contagious. In the case of the ratings agencies, it helped to infect the entire financial system. The major difference between a thing that might go wrong and a thing that cannot possibly go wrong is that when a thing that cannot possibly go wrong goes wrong, it usually turns out to be impossible to get at or repair, wrote Douglas Adams in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series. But how do the rating agencies' models, which had all the auspices of scientific precision, do such a poor job of describing reality? How the rating agencies got it wrong. We have to dig a bit deeper to find the source of the problem. The answer requires a little bit of detail about how financial instruments like CDOs are structured, and a little bit about the distinction between uncertainty and risk. CDOs are collections of mortgage debt that are broken into different pools or tranches, some of which are supposed to be quite risky and others of which are rated as almost completely safe. My friend Anil Kashyap, who teaches a course on the financial crisis to students at the University of Chicago, has come up with a simplified example of a CDO, and I'll use a version of this example here. Imagine you have a set of five mortgages, each of which you assume has a 5% chance of defaulting. You can create a number of bets based on the status of these mortgages, each of which is progressively more risky. The safest of these bets, what I'll call the alpha pool, pays out unless all five of the mortgages default. The riskiest, the epsilon pool, leaves you on the hook if any of the five mortgages defaults. Then there are other steps along the way. Why might an investor prefer making a bet on the epsilon pool to the alpha pool? That's easy, because it will be priced more cheaply to account for the greater risk. But say you're a risk-averse investor, such as a pension fund, and that your bylaws prohibit you from investing in poorly rated securities. If you're going to buy anything, it will be the alpha pool, which will assuredly be rated AAA. The alpha pool consists of five mortgages, each of which has only a 5% chance of defaulting. You lose the bet only if all five actually do default. What is the risk of that happening? Actually, that is not an easy question, and therein lies the problem. The assumptions and approximations you choose will yield profoundly different answers. If you make the wrong assumptions, your model may be extraordinarily wrong. One assumption is that each mortgage is independent of the others. In this scenario, your risks are well diversified. If a carpenter in Cleveland defaults on his mortgage, this will have no bearing on whether a dentist in Denver does. Under this scenario, the risk of losing your bet would be exceptionally small, the equivalent of rolling snake eyes 5 times in a row. Specifically, it would be 5% taken to the 5th power, which is just 1 chance in 3,200,000. This supposed miracle of diversification is how the rating agencies claimed that a group of subprime mortgages that had just a B-plus credit rating on average, which would ordinarily imply more than a 20% chance of default, had almost no chance of defaulting when pooled together. The other extreme is to assume that the mortgages, instead of being entirely independent of one another, will all behave exactly alike. That is, either all 5 mortgages will default, or none will. Instead of getting 5 separate rolls of the dice, you're now staking your bet on the outcome of just 1. There's a 5% chance that you will roll snake eyes and all the mortgages will default, making your bet 160,000 times riskier than you had thought originally. Which of these assumptions is more valid will depend on economic conditions. If the economy and the housing market are healthy, the first scenario, the 5 mortgages have nothing to do with one another, might be a reasonable approximation. Defaults are going to happen from time to time because of unfortunate rolls of the dice. Someone gets hit with a huge medical bill, or they lose their job. However, one person's default risk won't have much to do with another's. But suppose instead that there is some common factor that ties the fate of these homeowners together. For instance, there is a massive housing bubble that has caused home prices to rise by 80% without any tangible improvement in the fundamentals. Now you've got trouble. If one borrower defaults, the rest might succumb to the same problems. The risk of losing your bet has increased by orders of magnitude. The latter scenario was what came into being in the United States beginning in 2007. We'll conduct a short autopsy on the housing bubble later in this chapter. But it was the former assumption of largely uncorrelated risks that the rating agencies had bet on. Although the problems with this assumption were understood in the academic literature, and by whistleblowers at the ratings agencies long before the housing bubble burst, the efforts the rating agencies made to account for it were feeble. Moody's, for instance, went through a period of making ad hoc adjustments to its model in which it increased the default probability assigned to AAA-rated securities by 50%. That might seem like a very prudent attitude. Surely a 50% buffer will suffice to account for any slack in one's assumptions. It might have been fine had the potential for error in their forecasts been linear and arithmetic. But leverage or investments financed by debt can make the error in a forecast compound many times over and introduces the potential of highly geometric and nonlinear mistakes. Moody's 50% adjustment was like applying sunscreen and claiming it protected you from a nuclear meltdown, wholly inadequate to the scale of the problem. It wasn't just a possibility that their estimates of default risk could be 50% too low. They might just as easily have underestimated it by 500% or 5,000%. In practice, defaults were 200 times more likely than the ratings agencies claimed, meaning that their model was off by a mere 20,000%. In a broader sense, the ratings agency's problem was in being unable or uninterested in appreciating the distinction between risk and uncertainty. Risk, as first articulated by the economist Frank H. Knight in 1921, is something that you can put a price on. Say that you'll win a poker hand, unless your opponent draws to an inside straight. The chances of that happening are exactly 1 chance in 11. This is a risk. It is not pleasant when you take a bad beat in poker, but at least you know the odds of it and can account for it ahead of time. In the long run, you'll make a profit from your opponents making desperate draws with insufficient odds. Uncertainty, on the other hand, is risk that is hard to measure. You might have some vague awareness of the demons lurking out there. You might even be acutely concerned about them. But you have no real idea how many of them there are or when they might strike. Your back-of-the-envelope estimate might be off by a factor of 100 or by a factor of 1,000. There is no good way to know. This is uncertainty. Risk greases the wheels of a free market economy. Uncertainty grinds them to a halt.